Hello, on Tuesday, June 16th, 2015, you're listening to a BrianMedden.com live podcast. I'm Brian Medden from San Francisco, currently in the Tech Target office in San Francisco, sitting here with Jack. How are you today, Jack?
I am quite well.
Joining us via Skype is Gabe Knuth from Omaha. Hello, Gabe.
Howdy.
And our guest today is Rich Brumpton, joining us from, I'm assuming, St. Louis. Is that right, Rich?
Yep, I'm at the home office in St. Louis today.
And Rich is one of our sort of invited guests. Today's it's a non-sponsored podcast. It's just us kind of shooting the breeze. And Rich has been sort of a friend of the site, I guess, for, I don't know, we've known you for a long time.
Yeah, longer than either of us probably want to admit.
And, you know, I ran into you, Rich, you've been enterprise IT kind of around Citrix and Metaframe and server-based computing, I know, for a long time. And I ran into you, I think, at our VDI show in St. Louis when I was there. And we were just kind of chatting about Citrix and what you're seeing in the industry. And I know you've been on the consulting side and now you're in-house IT. And I figured it'd be cool just to kind of catch up and see what you were up to.
Yeah, this is a really cool opportunity for me as well. I was previously at MTM Technologies for 12 years through an acquisition there, and a lot of history there, and got to meet a lot of customers and work with a lot of folks and got a lot of opportunities to share with them what I saw and what was going on in the industry. And I didn't really have that opportunity once I got into a single company, so this is a great opportunity. Thanks a lot.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Well, and this is our first show in about a month or two because we were on the road with Synergy and Bri Forum and just kind of traveling around and everything. So we've got a lot to talk about because I want to talk about, you know, it's been a month since Synergy. And so we can talk about sort of what has happened since then. We saw Elliott Associates put their, you know, shareholder letter out to Citrix. And I think we have to talk about that. Sure. Jack, you were last night or today? I'm unclear on this. VMware announced something.
Yeah, they did it in a weird like two-stage process. They had an event last night for the press and analysts that was like public, but they're also doing the same thing again today.
But last time was an actual live, like it was something you went to here in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to talk about that. Gabe, what you got going on?
I don't know. It's sunny in Omaha. I'm excited because Kevin Goodman from FS Logix is actually in town. It's his first time to Omaha, so that I'm excited to take Kevin out for a steak. That's what I have going on.
Kevin is in Omaha. That's funny because I'm actually going on Thursday to see Kevin in Atlanta, so he'll get the full Brian and Gabe treatment, which is I hope that he treats me to steak when I'm in Atlanta. So Rich, you know, I'm curious. We sort of ask this of all of our guests, like just. I'm always curious on like how people got started in IT, and you know there's a lots of interesting stuff for us to talk about. So I don't want to go too deep into all this, mm-hmm. but you know at some point, how do you go from I guess your kid tinkering with computers to now you know you're on an enterprise IT podcast?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting topic for me because I had a little bit of a rocky road figuring that one out the hard way. I was one of those kids in junior high and high school that was super into the computer opportunities that I had, as limited as they were. But I took every one that I got, and I learned a whole bunch of stuff. I was in CAD classes because that's where the best computers in the high school were. And I thought after I got out of high school with all this knowledge that I'd packed into my brain and all this learning that I'd done, I was going to be able to put that to use and find somebody who's going to be able to use it right away. And the thing that I learned right out of the gate was that if even knowing something doesn't mean that you're going to be able to get in and talk to the other people that know that something. You're not going to be able to talk to the other people that know CAD at an organization until you've talked to HR. You're not going to be able to talk to the people that know the IT department the technology that they're working with until you've talked to somebody in HR, in recruiting, and somebody who doesn't have a technical bone in their body. So you have to have a way to kind of get through that. And I spent a bit of time doing a lot of other things as I was figuring out what I wanted to do exactly and how I was going to get into IT. But I finally got an opportunity to kind of do a kind of a tech support kind of position. And during that position, I had the opportunity to get certified. And I got my Cisco CCNA. That was kind of the first hit that was free, I guess. that was given to me by my employer at the time. And I went to this class as part of my work. It was awesome. It was the most interesting thing that I had come across in ages. It was put together well. And it just hit a giant light bulb for me. So I went and I got my Microsoft NT4 MCSE certification at the time. And then started. I was working for the government. It wasn't awesome. I wanted to not work for the government anymore. That was a personal choice. So I was looking for a position, and I found a training company here in St. Louis that was looking for somebody to teach other people technology. And I'd just gone through this learning process and was all excited about it. And so I was young enough that I put my hat in the ring for it, and they brought me up to St. Louis. We did an interview. We talked about the position. They ended up moving me up here and started training, teaching MCSE classes at the young old age of 25. It seems like it was a long time ago now.
It probably was a long time ago because now you're super old.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that.
But
we're all there.
How do you make the transition? You know, so this whole thing. So there's a lot more, especially in the 90s, a lot more NT4 MCSEs than there were, you know, Citrix engineers in the world. So mm-hmm. How do you make that transition into to this sort of sliver of the world?
So after I spent a couple years at the training company, they did some interesting stuff. We're going to gloss over, yep. And then I ended up at Vector. There's a couple of contracting gigs in between there, but Vector at the time was later MTM Technologies, were a local reseller that serviced pretty much every Citrix account in the St. Louis area. So when I joined their company, I knew terminal services, I knew Active Directory, I knew all my Microsoft technologies right, left, and center. But I didn't know about this Citrix layer on it until my interview. And I got the guy that interviewed me to give me an eval copy of the Citrix software, which I took home and I put on like my, I don't know, Intel Pentium 3 933 lab system that I had at home that I was running terminal services on. And I put the Citrix XP service pack, or 2, I think it was,
FR2,
yeah. At the time. Yeah, it was ages ago. So I put that on my lab server, and I was like hooked. I could get to it from anywhere. I had a Windows mobile phone that I could get to it from, and I mean, oh my goodness, it was just amazing technology. So I actually started pestering my future boss. I think I might have pestered him into hiring me. I'm not 100% sure. Because the technology was so compelling. It was so far ahead of just the simple terminal services model that I'd learned with straight NT4O and TSE that I just had a couple of servers of before. So that was what why the technology shift happened.
That's interesting because yeah. A lot of people who grew up more with Citrix first, then Microsoft kind of came into the game and was like, whoa, what's Microsoft doing on our territory? Ah, their stuff is not as good. It sucks. Like, they're not going to, you know, give Citrix a true run for their money. But with you, it's almost backwards. It's like you were a Microsoft person and got familiar with terminal services. And then you saw Citrix and was like, oh my God, look at how much this extends terminal services. This is awesome.
Yeah. And it did help that it was NT4 TSE. So yeah. It wasn't a shining example of terminal services like we have today with modern RDS.
Yeah.
That was very limited at the time.
So, I liked it around that time because it was just a fun story to tell people and watch them get it. You know, if you mm-hmm. could come up with a way to describe what thin client computing was, which I had to dig deep to remember that terminology even, but that just describing that type of technology to people and having them get it, it was such an easy win, and it was cool to see the reaction, and that was what hooked me back in the day.
Yeah, 2003, 2004, we still had customers that had 56 and 64K frame relay circuits and other things that they had to support that were horrible bandwidth. Lots of those customers with really compelling reasons on the protocol side that they'd been Citrix devotees for years. In fact, I got trained on Metaframe XP. And the very first thing that I got dropped into was trying to troubleshoot a Metaframe 1.8 environment. So that
what the hell is this? That's the way that goes. Browser thing.
You know Metaframe? Yeah, you got it. I've only ever seen one WinFrame world, and that was the same kind of thing. Like, yeah. Oh, Citrix. Yeah, that's Gabe.
Yeah, I actually had the opportunity to upgrade somebody off of WinFrame in 2007.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, and they were really annoyed because we had to buy six servers to replace two.
You know, I worked somewhere, and I can't remember where it was, but they actually had a WinFrame. So we got to talk, like, one of these conversations about how often you reboot your servers. And they had one server they had not rebooted in more than a year. It's like 400-something days. Mm-hmm. And because you could go into, why am I forgetting the word? Task manager, whatever, and see like how long the uptime was or whatever. It was a WinFrame. It was a WinFrame server, and this was comfortably into the, I want to say like Windows 2000 and stuff days. Like it was way later. And there's mm-hmm. one server. It's a whole data center, like a whole rack mounted data center, everything nice. And then there's one shelf with a tower server, probably a Prosignia or something like that. And this one WinFrame server, more than a year online, and they're basically like, we don't have any confidence it's going to come back up if we try to reboot it. And so it just sat there and it just kept on working.
Don't accidentally bump it.
Yeah, exactly. Anyone bumps this thing is fired because there's no way this is going back up.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that, that I hear over and over again, as I talk to folks that I know in the industry, is that there's this fear that you get after a certain point in time where you don't have enough of a net anymore. And you've had enough bad experiences with something that you've got to figure out a way to like migrate off of that. And how do you do that when it's something that's that old? It gets tough. It's something that's really one of the things I've been thinking a lot lately about is management and how to be more iterative and how to be more agile in the way that we manage infrastructure, which is it's someplace that we haven't seen a whole lot of the agile culture come over from the development side into a lot of our infrastructure shops. But there's a lot of lessons that I've kind of been learning from those guys that are interesting about trying to upgrade every single time you have the opportunity, even if it's not going to be awesome every time, just to make sure that you're keeping that up to date and that you've got the ability to keep it up to date, that you know that you can upgrade this thing and it's going to work 100% of the time.
You know, that's something interesting I never thought about, because I always think about sort of the cost to benefit, cost in terms of just mental effort and time taken and all that sort of stuff, you know, because most of the software today, you don't pay to upgrade because you're, you know, everyone's forced you into some subscriptions. You're kind of paying for it regardless of whether you upgrade or not. But that's interesting because you think about if you just upgrade every little step along the way, even though there might not be any value in the specific point upgrade you're doing, there is value in that you end up sort of always currently running the latest stuff so that then future upgrades are smaller. But I wonder if that ends up working out, you know, being less effort than if you did it the other way and you just said, well, we're not going to touch it for 5 years, but then you have to do just a massive like rebuild from scratch sort of every 5 years or whatever.
Yeah, also, and 5 years on, you've got a two-year project to replace the thing that takes a year to implement, so it's going to be 8 years old by the time you actually get it out.
Yeah.
Well, so tell me like the path of, you guys are talking like all these, years and years old Citrix servers and everything. I spent the last couple of weeks. I came from, there was VMware's event last night. There was MobileIron's event last week. Everyone's talking, Windows 10. And so like you can see a very clear path on the client side. Like, you know, this is the way that the mobile world is. This is the way that clients are now. And Windows 10 is going to be that new mobile way. You know, it just upgrades and does its thing. Mm-hmm. And so on my side, like I can see very, very clearly like how that happens. But is it ever going to be like that with, you know, our with XenApp servers and stuff?
So on the Citrix side of the world, they showed us the lifecycle management. I think I've got the branding right on that tool that they have inside the Workspace Cloud offering. That was really interesting to see because they're offering recipes and automation that allow you to reliably roll out and not just roll out, but keep up to date and scale and do other things with your environment kind of in a programmatic manner. This is an area where we haven't done a whole lot, but networking guys have been thinking about like software-defined networking for a while. How do you, instead of having a config file on your switch that is so tied to the hardware that you have to have a hardware expert every time you want to touch it, how do you get from that to something that you can generalize and run over and over again and use over and over again? So they've been thinking about this for a little while. This is kind of the cusp of where we're going to have to start thinking about this a little bit more. As you think about it, the desktop is an incredibly complex thing. We've got all the stuff for the desktop itself, the user experience stuff, the things behind the scene, all of the infrastructure, the SAN, the hypervisor, all the myriad of pieces that we have to support desktop virtualization. So we have to figure out a way to take that blistering amount of complexity and abstract it away to something that somebody can manage as a whole without necessarily being an absolute expert in all those areas. And that's what kind of the software-defined pieces start to allow us to do. And we can do that on some of it. On the storage, we saw the stuff that Citrix is announcing with software-defined storage vendors and partnerships with Atlantis and another one that's name is escaping me. So we're seeing this automation in the software-defined world, I think, come towards us a little bit. And we have to figure out how to deliver a desktop that's a modern desktop. And in order to do that, we're going to have to keep up with that Windows 10 cadence. So building that factory or machine that stamps out your infrastructure, updates your infrastructure for you, or buying it from or using it from a company like Citrix, I think is going to become increasingly important for something like a virtual desktop infrastructure.
What's going to be interesting, though, I think the catch is, you know, the whole sort of purpose of XenApp really is about delivering legacy Windows applications. Mm-hmm. And legacy Windows applications were built for the environment that assumes, you know, one user equals one PC with full admin rights and no conflicts and, you know, big screens and all that kind of stuff. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, you can look at all these points moving forward. Like if we had, you know, modern Windows apps and modern Windows platforms and all this kind of stuff, then we could do all these sort of nice modern type things and easy upgrades and make it more similar to the mobile upgrade and mobile lifecycle experience. But it's going to be interesting to see how, if they're able to sort of protect what legacy applications need in order to work. Because it's not just them having, you know, unlimited access to the C drive, and I say that purposefully using that phrase, the C drive, you know, and the admin rights, all that kind of stuff. But it's everything else that they need to go with them. Like they need access to this network share and this environment variable and this piece here and this plugin and this DLL and this registry key. And so, you know, if it were so easy to package up all the applications and sort of float them above all the infrastructure below, then we would have had like AppV taking care of this, you know, 10 years ago, and we would have AppV wrapped all of our apps and they would just magically still be working on Windows 10, but they're not. So I don't know. Like I kind of to Jack's question, I'm sort of skeptical that we'll ever see this with legacy Windows applications. And I feel like that's a big thing with XenApp and VDI in general is, you know, we have to recognize that the Windows desktop and Windows applications are legacy apps. Like they are the way they are because that was the environment in which they were built. And that's never going to change. So I don't know how much better we really can get to, you know, providing them like the more mobile, like at least from packaging and upgrading and, you know, like that kind of experience.
But those applications aren't going to be upgraded either. You know, there's not rapid updates coming out for those applications, and any new iterations of them are going to be created in a new way. I mean, as time goes by, there's going to be fewer updates for those old style applications. And so if we still have to manage and maintain those old applications, I think that's the stuff that Rich is talking about with the life cycle. Like we can, it's the stuff that we also talk about every day. We can package them and deliver them in a more modern way without having to deal with all the bullshit that we had to worry about years ago.
Yeah. There's kind of two kinds of environments to think about in your IT data center. There's the living and the dead. There's all of the stuff that's actually got a project next year and the year after that that's going to keep going and can keep the thing humming along. And then there's the thing that got built 3 years ago or 5 years ago or 22 years ago that's sitting in a corner of a data center effectively Living Dead zombie servers. Those we're going to protect and keep in a cage so they don't escape and infect the other servers, probably.
Right, your WinFrame server that's in the corner that you're too afraid to reboot.
You're right.
Exactly. So, I mean, you're going to treat those. And CERN has a great analogy. They refer to these as cows and pets. Pets are the ones that you're going to heal and make well if something goes wrong with them. Cows, you're going to take that gun from No Country for Old Men, and you're going to get rid of the cow, and you're going to get a new cow. That's just the way cows work.
Time for a new cow.
Time for a new cow. And,
that's just the way cows work.
And we are going to get you a better cow.
Exactly. And that's the way that automated deployment infrastructures work as well. The continuous deployment model where you take and you say, okay, I'm not going to take the ZenApp server and remove the 6.5 components and put the 7.5 components in order to do my upgrade. I'm going to build the thing from scratch, put all the applications in there so that I know how to install those applications so I don't lose that expertise. You have to make sure you're not losing expertise when you stale things. And be very careful what you're staling and putting kind of in that living dead state. It should either be alive or dead, not one or the other. And you're not going to be successfully resurrecting things very often. That's a painful process. More often, you're going to be migrating off of them to some other tool that will then live for a while and then die. And hopefully, eventually, in the cloud world, when things die, they'll go away.
So I want to shift gears a little bit. At your current role, you're in-house at a large enterprise. Are you able to talk about what you guys are doing? Are you Windows 7? What your thoughts are around Windows 8, around Windows 8.1, around Windows 10? What are you doing with Citrix? Are you excited about Citrix Workspace Cloud? Versus ZenApp, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, is in-house IT, is DAS even a thing?
Yeah.
So DAS is let me draw a separation here because I don't want to specifically talk about what we're doing inside EHI, but I can freely talk about what I'm interested in. I am very interested in DAS, and it's relevant. So DAS is something that is where we need to go for desktop virtualization in order to get all of the unnecessary complexity out of the hands of people in our organization that through excesses of caring make it way too difficult to work with. That's basically what I think is one of our biggest barriers to a virtualized desktop is the fact that we have to get all the mind share and all the persuasion together to actually get everybody on board to kind of do things the way that's going to support that virtual desktop properly. Or we have to go our own path and ignore all the lessons that have been learned in other parts of the organizations to a large extent while we focus in on one solution. And I've seen both of those. And they both can go too far. So it's very important to figure out what you need to care about. And with virtual desktops, it's the desktop. I don't care about the SAN, really. So DAS is awesome.
What about the, Gabe and I were very excited about DAS a year ago, and I still believe that there's still a lot of misconceptions about it because a lot of people are out there, and I don't remember where this was. I was saying this kind of recently. People are saying, oh, well, we work for blah, X big enterprise, and we can never do anything in the cloud. I'm like, that's malarkey because I guarantee you right now, everyone's got something in the cloud. Every enterprise has got something in the cloud. And what might just be one app here and there, or they're using, some cloud-based service or something somewhere. But for enterprise to say, okay, we can't do DAS because we don't trust the cloud, that's BS. Now, that said, though, it's also super complex. In the article I wrote a few months ago about DAS, is the fact that DAS, the Windows desktop is so complex in that it has so many moving parts that, you just put your desktop in the cloud, but that doesn't do anything. You also need your apps, and the apps need the data, and they need these files, and they need this authentication, and then this app needs that app, and this one needs that database. And now you have to move more and more and more up into the cloud in order to make the whole thing work. And then what about the users who are left behind? Do you make everyone go to DAS, or do you make fat pipes, or do you replicate the data? And that, to me, seems what's causing DAS to not be successful at the enterprise level. And so I'm just wondering, Now I'm going to be like that annoying questioner. Do you agree?
Expand.
Let me pretend I'm a politician and talk about something near it. if you look at, oh, let's see, where was I going with that? If you look at the offerings out there, they're not offerings to IT. They're offerings to the business. And that's who the cloud rightfully should be selling to, is the business. Maybe some of our IT, because we're going to be using cloud services, yes. But the business is really where you should be selling a cloud desktop. And because of that, you have Microsoft coming at it from an app angle, where you have Remote App is their DAS solution. So you can do any desktop you like as long as it's an application. It's a really cool DAS solution that at some point I'm sure will have more desktop features. And then we'll have auto-scaling terminal services desktops from Microsoft, assuming they decide to offer that. So, I mean, it's looking like it's growing in that direction. You got Amazon, who's been growing in the opposite direction. They started with a VDI offering, really. It had a server OS, but Workspaces uses a VDI model for to a large degree. And now they're layering on applications in their own kind of style. And what's really informative to me is the way that they're attacking their applications is a little bit different, because they're doing it like a cloud vendor. They're doing it at a massive scale that nobody in IT would ever think to do. Even in a 100,000 person organization, you're not going to give the app V organization 20 or 30 people to go do what they need to do. You're going to give them the bare minimum in order to get the stuff packaged. So the cloud scale attention to some of this stuff, I think, might let us take some of those legacy concerns that you were mentioning earlier, Brian, and some of the spidery concerns. I think that's something that they're going to have to address with a lot of work. That's a huge slippery slope that we got to avoid. But for an individual business unit and the business saying, hey, I've got salespeople that wander around this area of the world and they need a virtual desktop in order to support them, and I'm going to have them buy a laptop, and I'm going to make the decision to go ahead and do that. That use case is narrow enough that we don't have to worry about that giant spider web. It's when you start your cloud VDI thinking with IT or some other like central, massively integrated business component that you suddenly have every database security structure on the planet called into question. And things like that. Then that's the thing that kills a lot of DAS conversations, is when you go at it as a general usage thing right off the bat. Look at it as a tactical play. That's where they really are today.
Well, frankly, and that's the reason why we talk about why RDSH and XenApp type solutions have been successful, where VDI itself has not been perceived as successful. In that the RDSH sort of single app solutions were going after very tactical things. Like, I have this app for these users and it's problematic for this reason, so I will fix that with XenApp. Whereas VDI is like, oh, we can use VDI for everyone else where you couldn't use XenApp. And of course, that's a recipe for failure. And I guess the same is true for DAS.
And what you said with RDSH right now, replace that with DAS.
Yeah.
As in going for the very narrow use cases.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. So, Rich, you were at Synergy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Go. And what's your, you get back to the office and the folks who didn't go to Synergy were like, hey, man, how was Synergy? What do you tell them?
So Synergy was really interesting. It looked to me like Citrix is really trying to figure out the next generation, as well as kind of really putting the bolsters where they needed to on the existing stuff. There's a lot of the pieces that we've been kind of waiting for, kind of coming together, finally maturing, finally turning into something that we can try, like the Workspace Cloud stuff starting to mature and starting to turn into something. The deployment tool that I mentioned earlier is fantastic, just as a starting point, but there's a lot of work to do for Citrix there still. The other things that were really interesting were the things that were kind of outside of the core, which I think is going to go to our Elliot conversation in a minute. But the things outside of the core were really interesting to me because it showed that Citrix was looking for synergies in other markets and other places that they could build themselves into a multi-legged stool. I mean, we had Mark Templeton ride around on a hobby horse once for Citrix Summit. And he was talking about the one-trick pony problem. And if you remember the days of Citrix being totally a one-trick pony behind Metaframe, they were so focused and so narrow on what they were really thinking they needed to deliver to us customers that took them in a direction that once the market shifted just a little bit, kind of yanked the rug out from under them. And they had to quickly figure out that, this other thing is interesting and maybe we need to get into some other areas and look at network and look at bringing together the other pieces of the stack that we might need in order to provide bigger services. So, the OctoBlue acquisition is especially interesting to me because it's kind of a way to allow you to plumb together all sorts of Internet of Things devices. And it similarly provides a communication layer like we did with virtual desktops. The Internet of Things is like the ultimate virtualized desktop, right, or virtualized application. You've got a button, a light, and maybe a little screen with some information on it, and that's about it. Maybe it has a sensor that detects you when you walk up, and there's not much to it. And all of the integration for that thing is done in the cloud. So it's like kind of the ultimate in a virtualized application. It's fully virtualized.
It's interesting. I mean, do you think is that where Citrix belongs in the IoT space? I mean, I agree that it is interesting stuff, but does that...
Do you
feel that blends with what Citrix is doing currently?
I don't know. I honestly don't. It ties into the workspace message, and some of this stuff all does come together around their workspace message very well. The Yelp type thing that they showed,
I watched that for five minutes before I realized that was not a Citrix app. You know, mm-hmm. that they were just showing off like some rando application that was wrapped with their works thing or whatever the hell, or integrated.
That was just a rando app.
Yeah, that Yelp thing that thing where you go to like you vote on like co-working spaces and how good they are. Yeah, that wasn't their app. That exists. That was just something. It was just like, look, there's apps that are mobile and they can make you productive on the road. And I'm like,
mobile devices.
Don't be damned, huh? Yeah. But no, like that's it, right? Yeah. See, and Jack, you're a mobile guy, and you didn't even know that wasn't. No, that's not a Citrix app. That's just something they were showing off.
Huh? Yeah. Because they've been making a lot of apps.
Yeah.
They have something that they will privately preview for customers today. I'm not sure if it's the same thing or if it's an evolved version or if it's something slightly different. But it allows you to basically rate the facilities that you're
using. Yeah, wasn't that Cube Free?
Yes, Cube
Free. Synergy?
Yeah, that was it.
And that's a Citrix product.
Yeah, that's a Citrix product. That's the one I was kind of thinking of, actually.
Cube Free is the Citrix product?
Yeah.
It may be somebody else's technology under the covers. I wouldn't put that beyond them, especially in an initial version. That would be very smart of them. But the concept behind it is very interesting because this is an area that I know in traditional IT we've got issues with traditional facilities all over the place. Maybe we could evolve that a little bit. Let them know when a conference room is an absolute disaster and doesn't work properly or the chairs are all been stolen from a conference room or something like that. So I see that honestly just in-house might be interesting. But for the target audience of the mobile workforce that's like scattered around a city and coming together in random places or not random ones but self-selected places and doing things, I think they've got a valuable tool that will give them potentially maybe a market, but it's going to be a great way to get to know their customers. I think they're learning to do something which is actually in the agile world and the lean world, which is go and see. And even if this doesn't turn into a big project or a big product of theirs that they release to the wild, It's going to give them good insight into how people that need this mobile workspace concept actually work in the real world and what things they like and don't like.
And it's like welcome to our new mobile world. I think I'll have to double check, but like I think like the Receiver X1, like it supports like reviews for I'll have to double check on that, but if it doesn't support that, it should.
Because that's one of the things, right? Like you can review your own published Windows app. Like they publish, you know, queue support for you and your help desk tickets. And
yeah,
I can give it 1 star. Like this app sucks.
Or
imagine what a wasteland that will become.
Well, when I talk to companies that are like especially there are a few vendors that I talk to that are always great because they're like 100% concentrated on this world, and they're like, yeah, we've talked before about this idea that obviously like your huge Windows app becomes many different like three function task specific workflow mobile apps, and for that to work, you actually need to be, you know, your users need to be like, I need this button here, and like this app sucks and this app is awesome, and so that all those like dozens or hundreds or thousands of apps like this and when we talk about this, I wonder like yeah, your company is going to have hundreds of mobile apps that you're going to have to worry about, and they're going to be constantly evolving, so get excited
awesome.
About that.
I just can't imagine. I mean, the rating thing seems to me like, yeah, okay, we need to have feedback on how these applications are, but the rating system to me just seems worthless. Like, Gazette and Plus, you have options.
Like Ralphie. Crying.
Yeah.
Turning his knob towards sad.
Right, but I think we need star ratings. We just need like thumbs up, thumbs down. Like this app sucks. Like this app.
Well,
is
regardless,
not
I hate all of them because they're work.
Well, yeah. Like,
but that's why it's going to be a wasteland.
But what's interesting though is okay, TechTarget. We have an app called PDS. It's an internally developed app that's called like Product Delivery System, and it's how we do everything from every campaign, every product, all the assets to the clients.
For.
Yeah, the client assets, deliverables. Broken them into campaign, into geos, into it is the like that is the enterprise app that is TechTarget behind the scenes, PDS.
Mm-hmm.
You can't rate PDS because whether you like it or not, well, TechTarget runs on PDS and that's the, you know, everyone needs it. What's interesting though, to Jack's point, is so PDS right now, it's a web-based app, but it's a web-based, you know, desktop app that has like a billion subcomponents and a billion tabs and all that kind of thing. And to make a mobile version of PDS, I feel like if you sort of make the quote-unquote traditional mobile version of an app, you're trying to take all that functionality and make it work on a smaller screen, whereas that's not really what we need to do. We really need to say we actually need to make, you know, 50 mobile apps, because what I want out of PDS and what the trafficker wants out of PDS and what the campaign manager wants out of PDS and the sales manager, like these are all, you know, different kinds of things. And then you could rate those, like, you know, if I'm a trafficker, I do 4 things. We actually have jobs at TechTarget called traffickers, and they're the ones who, like, collect the banner ads and collect the assets and put them into the things and set up the delivery systems, and, you know, then different people run their ports, but they do all this kind of stuff. Like, they might need 4 different things. Like, they might need an app that says, hey, I can't set up this campaign because I'm waiting on this asset, and this asset just got put in there, and I want a notification that asset shows up so I can now throw it in the campaign or whatever. Like, that would be one thing that they...
That's one of their 4 apps.
Yeah.
Like, if it's like, okay, for this workflow, we really need this button in it too, then you submit that in the feedback form, and it's like the consumer-friendly, you know, just like delivering feedback on an app in you know, to Apple or something. But the thing that I want to point out here is, like, you mentioned, like, you know, small mobile size screens, but like this applies to large screens and mice and keyboard apps. I mean, look at what look at the SAP Fiori concept, which is their new, like, it's so the concept of how they like redo the UI so it's actually friendly. And of course, they're getting like most of their motion with apps that are meant for small touchscreen devices. But this new, like, rapidly evolving task specific you know, modern world, like this applies to large screen keyboard mouse applications too.
And is there some kind of orchestration back end? Is this an OctoBlue thing? Because now at some point it's going to be this, you know. So yeah, I've got 50 apps that are all very task specific. So I like that. And then, or especially like in the mobile cases. But then this, you know, what I need to do is this button, like, which is ordinarily, well, I've got three apps that do something in my workflow. And if I want to make that into a single quote unquote mobile app, it actually needs to launch and do in sequence three separate functions from three different applications.
So this is where an MBAS comes in, a mobile backend as a service. It's your, like, this is your translation layer that I'm making air quotes API-ifies, you know, everything so that you can develop your clients against that.
Is this like what Redo and them are
how
doing?
You want?
Or this is
think of like Redo and them as a more focused version, you know, because you know their approach is going in through your existing Windows applications, but other you know, other ones, their approaches are like, how do we connect to this database and how do we connect to this feed? And then, you know, you have your central like MBAS in the middle that you can use as your central aggregation point to like completely remux everything.
So this is like BizTalk. We talked about this. Like, yes. We mentioned this a few weeks ago. Yeah. So is it BizTalk for 2015?
I'm not familiar with BizTalk.
I heard Rich say yes.
So yeah, BizTalk is basically the same idea. It's been knocking around since 2000, 2002. Yeah. I don't know. It's been a long time.
It was part of the Office. Yeah, NT. It's part of the back office suite. There's a brand for it.
So yeah, it'll virtualize APIs, basically allow you to change things around and do that same kind of thing. But yeah, I think this MBAS concept is kind of that next generation of this concept. BizTalk was the installed infrastructure world version of it, and I think there is something in Azure that is similar, so that might be in that space.
Who's MBAS? Like, who does that?
So this is, like, this is, remember, like, last year I spent all summer going sort of down the wormhole into mobile app development platforms.
Right.
And realized that there are, like, approximately 1 million of them. And the easiest thing to say without, like, spending 90 hours a week following the space is just go and look. Whatever you need, it's there somewhere.
I'm going to bing it. MBAS. Speaking of binging, so I decided. Like, all right, go on.
I don't know, like, it was probably like Kony, which is one of the, you know, moderately well-known MADPs that I might have first heard the term from.
I'm laughing because did I teach
Kony MBAS?
Did I jump the shark?
We just got old and shitty at our jobs.
That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. I just jumped the career shark. Because there's all these acronyms, and I almost said there's too many goddamn acronyms that I don't understand.
Didn't you see the cover of my book?
Oh, yeah. It was like with 20 more acronyms or whatever.
Yeah. MBAS. MBAS, MADP.
You can't Google MBAS because it turns it into MBAs, like plural. Well, at least Bing does. So I did this thing a few weeks ago where I decided that, like, Google Chrome was just always, you know, I mean, I always had like 50 to 75 tabs open probably, and I always, Chrome was just like my fan was on. Chrome's open, fans on, like, that's how it was, right? So then I went to Firefox to try that for a little while, and Firefox was fine. It's still like Firefox open, fan on. I'll tell you what browser though is pretty good on Mac, man. Safari. It's
I've never heard of that.
It's right. It's
Safari.
It's crazy, man.
Spell it for me. Wait, I'm gonna try to find it in my spotlight.
Yeah. So I don't know. Like, Jack, your point though, no Google offline. Ironically, Mail. So we use TechTarget. Like email, you know, I mean, TechTarget Emails Exchange 2013, which is offline, and offline, I could not make work in Chrome. That works fine in Safari and Firefox for mail, but
in OAuth,
yeah. But I could not get but Google Docs doesn't work offline except in Chrome. So I don't know what, but anyway, that was a little side note. But anyway, so that's why I'm binging things now, just to see, because I figured, like, you know, also now that I'm getting older and crotchety, I might as well, like, not give all my stuff to one. Like, I like the idea of, you know, like, use one vendor for your browser, use the second vendor for your OS, a third vendor for your email, a fourth vendor for your searching, and just kind of, like, spread. Of course, now that's going to mean that, you know, you give all your personal information now essentially to four companies instead of one.
I'm looking down at my MacBook Air, my iPhone 6, and my Apple Watch.
Uh-oh.
But then you've got Chrome with Gmail. And all right, anyway, that's off topic. What browser do you like, Rich?
I use generally whatever the platform comes with is my first choice, and Chrome is my kind of cross-platform second choice, depending on what I'm doing. If it's just my personal browsing, I do most of that in Chrome.
What's your daily driver?
So I have Chrome and Safari open every day on my MacBook. I've got a 2013 MacBook Pro that has been serving me pretty well for the last couple of years.
Okay, let's go back to Citrix. This is interesting, by the way. I think we should have you back on future of these shows because I feel like there's a lot we can talk about, and so let's do this again.
Sure.
But, you know, so we were kind of tiptoeing into the Citrix and Elliott and Focus and that kind of stuff, and, you know, Citrix becoming a one-trick pony. And so they, you know, starting back in 2003, they came out with the Citrix Access Suite and bought, you know, Sequoia and licensed V1 and tried to start doing some other things. And, you know, 2004, they bought Net6. 2005, they bought NetScaler. I might have those years wrong. But, you know, they started doing all the networking stuff. They bought Citrix Online, or they bought X Obsidian in, like, 2003. So around the early 2000s, they started sort of branching out. And, you know, those have been, like, the NetScaler and GoTo businesses are very successful. But there's a conversation about, you know, whether, like, how related they are. Because I could say also, like, the Printer Ink business is a very successful business also. So, like, why doesn't Citrix, like, buy a Printer Ink business? Like, it's going to be pure profit. You know, so it's a gambling business. They should make gambling machines.
I mean, why doesn't HP divest their Printer Ink business? I mean, it's the same kind of thing. How many lines of business do you need in an organization in order to provide a solid support structure that the entire organization can move forward in an uncertain world? That's often what you see when you start getting beyond a certain size. Not everything starts working together. Some organizations try to make it work together and fail. Others just realize that they're going to have different divisions and just kind of have them all support each other when one of their boats doesn't come in from sea, because that happens sometimes. We've seen desktop virtualization almost achieve, how many times now? That's getting depressing.
it's also interesting too, because, you know, I can understand Citrix not, you know, if they get rid of these higher, you know, sort of marginally related, unrelated businesses that are just very profitable and very successful, you know, that leaves their core. And what is their core? Is their core legacy? Is it legacy Windows applications? Because the whole notion of, like, what Jack was talking about of, you know, it's all about mobility, and not mobility meaning mobile devices, but the mobile workforce. And Citrix is all about legacy apps, web apps, mobile, small form factor, you know, screen, tablet apps, providing that all to you anywhere, anytime, securely, identity, all that kind of stuff. But that's IT, like, that's the world in general. So in the old days, you could say, oh, Citrix is about mobile enabling your, you know, line of business applications. Again, even laptop at Starbucks, counting in the mobile category here, working from home.
But it's kind of like,
now everyone's doing that. Like, that's just the thing. That's just IT in 2015. It's like, yeah, people work from everywhere now.
Yeah, you've got to. Citrix has to have a compelling, forward-looking direction that they can take forward, other than supporting legacy apps. Is kind of the rub there. The supporting legacy apps business is one that you expect the doors to shut on eventually, or they're going to have to move to supporting other kinds of legacy apps or something like that. It's a different kind of business than Citrix has been trying to build over the last couple of decades. Talking about connecting people between their things that they need and where the, and the people where they are. I mean, that's really what Citrix has been talking about consistently and everything that they've been doing for the most part. I mean, there's been some wobbles here and there, but really been talking about connecting people to the things that they need.
But
so,
that's a problem now because that's what Microsoft, like,
that's what everybody does.
How's that different than Microsoft today?
Or MobileIron or VMware?
It's a different world. And I mean, the mobility play, I think, honestly, is it's being used as a mobility play. But over time, it's just going to be the how we get things plumbed together in our infrastructure play. Right. It's going to generalize more. We're going to see laptops and other devices come into the fold, as it were, feature wise. I know I've been pestering the heck out of Citrix on a good solid story of being able to do internal and external HTML-based applications through my Netscaler from laptop devices. It's not as awesome a story as it could have been over the years. And now they've got some of the Unified Gateway stuff coming out and some of the other things they've announced on the mobility side, where we might eventually see things on the mobility of the mobility type, the MicroVPN style connections. We might eventually see those coming from our laptop devices and have containers on the laptop devices that we can trust. So,
like in the way that it works on mobile devices today. Yeah.
Like Workspot or like the Mocha 5 product, that the one that I was excited about last before.
Yeah, big shout out to Ron over Workspot.
So yeah, like I'm all for those like mobile like containers for PCs. Awesome for for Workspot to be doing that. I like it.
Yeah. And I think Microsoft is also kind of headed that direction. I'm not 100% sure that they're going to extend it all the way down to the desktop, but at the server level, their containers support and their Docker support sets them up to be able to offer security containers that are much, much lighter weight than a virtual machine would ever be down on the client end as well, assuming that that technology scales down that way.
I don't want to belabor this. Maybe this is a topic for a different conversation. But again, if you look at that vision from Citrix, and then let's look at the vision from Microsoft, like how is Citrix able to articulate a vision for what they see themselves doing and fitting into the IT ecosystem of the next, say 10 years? I wonder what Citrix possibly sees them doing that is different from what Microsoft is doing.
It's not going to be what's different. It's going to be where their value differentiators on top of Microsoft and or other service providers are. I'm almost certain of that. That's just kind of a personal opinion. But they are very good enhancers of value plays. So you're going to see Citrix take and introduce things that will make Azure better in one way or another, or make Internet of Things better in one way or another with OctoBlue, or I mean, pick a topic. They're not necessarily, I don't think, going to try to head-to-head replace infrastructure that Microsoft's trying to build. I mean, Microsoft, with their number of engineering staff and everything on the Azure world, I mean, they could eat Citrix's lunch in a very few number of development cycles if they really decided to focus on something.
So that's interesting. So there, with that, look at how the Citrix core now is different than, for example, Citrix Online or Netscaler. Because Citrix Online is a full product top to bottom that competes against Microsoft, other offerings that exist out there. Netscaler is a full product platform top to bottom that competes against other kind of full top to bottom things. Whereas the other businesses, as it's been said in the comments, are those enhancers. So maybe that by that reasoning, that could be get rid of these businesses that are full stacks and now focus on enhancing other people's stuff instead of having enhancements side by side with full stacks.
But even with all the developments in Intune and EMS and especially Office 365, that's getting it's getting harder to work along with that instead of directly competing with it.
But at least that's something that they're familiar with. Like, that's what they've been doing forever. And the whole thing about, oh, Microsoft or whatever company else you're enhancing is going to offer more. And then you can focus on the specific usability enhancements and stuff. I don't know. We should continue this conversation, but we have to do it at a different time. Before we run out of time completely today, I want to get from you, Jack. You went to this VMware. I don't even know what it was. It was something from VMware last night around EUC or mobility. What was it, and what did you learn? What's VMware doing now? Is there anything to announce?
So it was their VMware Enterprise Mobility event. They had a number of announcements. One was, and this is interesting that it was so much mobile related. Yet it was all like under VMware branding, as opposed to AirWatch branding. So I guess like that's just a sign of things. Things
the
coming find together
replace
more.
Is complete.
Yeah. So they announced and talked to their commitment to, I forget what the exact wording were, but their like commitment to supporting Apple and with EMM doing things the Apple way. They talked about their app configuration for enterprise program, which is it's a whole mobile app configuration thing, and that does it in. It's basically they're encouraging the use of – they're encouraging doing things the Apple way.
And wait, so this is – yeah, but to be clear, this is called VMware Ace. Now, probably before your time, Ace was a different thing. You're familiar.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And this is not that. But so there's now a product called VMware Ace. It's application configuration
– for enterprise.
What is the
– so it's – so we – a big long mobile app management discussion. Basically, it's using frameworks provided by Apple, and also in theory they'll be coming from Android as well to encouraging these use of standard frameworks to configure applications instead of proprietary SDKs and app wrappers. But the problem is that using the Apple frameworks introduces some dependencies in that you have to manage the device with MDM. And that's still, you know, whether that's going to be, like, it's great. Also, the great thing about Ace is that all, like, if it's there in an application, any MDM vendor can support it. But the question is whether, this is an 80% use case thing or 95% or 50% use case. They're all into it. I'm still saying, like, hey, we have to be cognizant of these other ways.
Yeah.
So that was one announcement. Another was, support for AT&T's split work personal billing thing.
Support in what? In AirWatch?
Yeah. But the big one was VMware Identity Manager. Now, of course, both AirWatch and VMware have been, you know, there's been Workspace Portal, and before that Horizon, and before that Project Origami. So it's not like, of course, they've had, you know, identity management and single sign-on products for a long time. The difference is now there's much more mobile and desktop integration. Like, you look at the VMware Identity Manager, it does single sign-on into the mobile apps, and it can take into account like whether or not the device is managed in AirWatch. So it's basically like the AirWatchified newest rev of that. And, you know, in the last 8 months or so, Microsoft has been like very bullish about how like we're the best about, you know, identity management combined with mobility. And so they're bringing the AirWatch and Horizon Workspace Portal stuff together. Which is great, and also they're like answering that challenge.
Wow. Okay, so we're out of time today. This is the first time it's happened in a while where I actually just have more questions at the end of the podcast than I did at the beginning of the podcast. But I think it was, from my standpoint, it's a great conversation. And Rich, I think you bring a perspective that is more nuanced than my. Yeah, loud screaming. and so I appreciate it, and I do hope that you'd join us again and because I really want to continue a lot of the conversations we started. So this is kind of just scratching the surface, but I feel like there's a lot of interesting topics we sort of brought up today, and I look forward to spending the rest of the summer over these next few months digging into all this stuff a lot more.
Yeah, I'd be happy to dig in more with you. It's a great opportunity again. And I am, if anybody's interested, I am working on a little side project trying to figure out some of this Citrix manageability stuff and where we might be going. So if you have any thoughts or opinions on it and you want to hit me up, I'm at BrumpTech. You also might have my email or know me from LinkedIn.
Yeah, so we'll put links to that stuff in the show notes. And I want to learn more about that too personally. So maybe we can connect offline. And I don't know if you want to write about what you're doing. You know, you want to blog on brianmadden.com, that's cool. Or if you've got a site to point people to, then we can blog and point people there. But let's talk more about that as well.
Sounds good.
Awesome. Okay, well, Rich, thank you so much for joining today. Also, Gabe, thanks for joining. Jack, thank you. Mariah, our project manager. Justin, our engineer, thank you guys as well. And for you all listening, thanks so much. From San Francisco, this is Brian Madden, and this was BrianMadden.com live podcast. So long.